Well, so we've reached now the end of the Sermon on the Mount. And no one who listens to the Sermon on the Mount with their heart can come away untouched, can they? Deeply, personally challenging, as no doubt Jesus intended. For myself, I know my pride, my half-hearted piety, my having made peace with my own sin. These things are just clearly called out in the things we've passed. What's clear is that it's not about the other guy, is it? So let's hear these words from God, the authoritative voice of God directly speaking into our personal and daily lives. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will recognize them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will recognize them by their fruits. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? And I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall, because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. When Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who has authority, not as one of their scribes.
Hello. So Byron nailed it. We would all do well to, every day this week, read the Sermon on the Mount and say to ourselves, it is not about the other guy. I know my aunt really needs to hear this, so do I. In his book, A Walk in the Woods, Bill Bryson tells the story of hiking the Appalachian Trail with his friend Stephen Katz. Katz had never been backpacking before. And at the beginning of the trip, he loaded down his pack with about 80 pounds of gear and food and clothing. And on their first day on the trail, Bryson got way ahead of Katz, so far ahead that he became concerned and decided to backtrack. And he finds Katz at the top of the last hill, panting and exhausted, and sitting on top of a pack with a lot less than 80 pounds of stuff in it. It turns out that in a fit of worn-out rage, Katz had unloaded his entire pack and thrown about half of its contents over a cliff, never to be seen again. You see, not having been backpacking before, Katz knew that life in the woods was different from life on the couch. It's not like he tried to bring his television or his favorite recliner with him. But he didn't understand just how different, and so he foolishly attempted a compromise. He didn't have the TV or the recliner, but he did have a folding chair and several boxes of Twinkies. You know, some of life's simple comforts. And it was only by hard experience that he learned that when you have to carry them on your back up and over one mountain after another, those simple things aren't comforts at all. The point is, sometimes the things you think are essential to life are actually killing you. They promise life, and then at the very same time stop you from experiencing that life. In our text this morning, Jesus concludes the Sermon on the Mount by describing two ways of life as different as life in the woods and life on the couch. And he describes them in order to warn us against one and invite us into the other. To invite us into kingdom of heaven life and to warn us that if we would enter that life, some of the things we hold dear, some of the things we find comfort in, will have to be thrown over a cliff, never to be seen again. So, first, Jesus is forcefully clear that we are faced with a choice between two and only two options. He speaks of two gates, one leading to destruction and the other leading to life. He speaks of two kinds of trees, one healthy and fruitful, the other diseased and fruitless and bound for the fire. He speaks of two houses, one built on the rock that endures the storm, and one that is swept away. Jesus never, not here and not anywhere else, acknowledges the possibility that there is some kind of middle ground, neutral territory, or third option. This doesn't sit well with modern ears. When you hear Western people say they think Jesus is a good teacher, they're usually not thinking of this teaching. They have other things in mind. In our society, everyone is supposed to be able to build and then enter their own gate, plant and grow their own kind of tree, put their house wherever they want, you know, assuming that they follow the not at all onerous Corvallis zoning laws and building codes. Low-hanging fruit. The classic picture of how our world views religion and spirituality and life in general is to imagine a great mountain with God or nirvana or paradise or the good life or whatever at the top, and all of us at different points around the bottom of the mountain trying to find our way up. And the point is that we all start from different places and we all take different paths, but all the paths lead to the top of the mountain. And so the only sin you can really commit is to assume you're on the right path and all those other people at different places on the mountain are on the wrong path. I mean, after all, who are we to say that religion is right and secularism is wrong? That Christianity is right and Islam is wrong? Or that Presbyterians are right and Catholics are wrong? Jesus teaches the opposite of that. If you believe that picture of the mountain and you are becoming offended by Jesus, that means you are starting to understand him correctly. Jesus says, forget about the mountain. The whole picture is garbage. You and everyone else are at a fork in the road, and I'm there with you. I'm taking the right-hand turn, and I am the author of life. Follow me or die. I am giving you a choice, and there are two and only two options. If that's the case, if Jesus is right, then what those two options are and the difference between those options becomes rather important. And that's what we're going to spend the rest of the sermon on. And here, Jesus gives an answer about the difference that is itself very different from what we or his original audience might expect. In the midst of his words about gates and trees and houses, Jesus defines that difference. Look at verse 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Okay, so then the one who enters the kingdom of heaven is the one who does the will of Jesus' Father in heaven. Doing the Father's will is the difference. But how do we do that? And all the Christians in the room find themselves wondering, wait a second, did Jesus just say that we're saved by doing the right thing, by works? That can't be right, can it? When you're studying Scripture and you don't understand something, always start by looking at the context. If verse 21 confuses you, look at what comes before and after and see if there are any clues to understanding it. And in this case, we get one clue each from the before and the after. The before is much broader. Keep in mind that Jesus is concluding a sermon. He has been talking about righteousness, about doing the Father's will, since chapter 5. So if you find yourself asking, wait, what is it to do the Father's will? Jesus' answer would be, everything I just said. The entire sermon. That's the before context clue. The after one comes immediately after in verses 22 and 23, which read, on that day many will say to me, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And cast out demons in your name? And do many mighty works in your name? And then I will say to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Jesus is imagining a day on which people come to him seeking entrance into life, entrance into the kingdom of heaven. And these are folks whose spiritual resumes are just light years beyond yours and mine. These folks have planted underground churches in Saudi Arabia. They spent their youth freeing young women from the sex trade. They have given away their fortunes in the name of Jesus. And they come to Jesus asking to be let into his kind of life. And it's important to see that Jesus doesn't say, you know what? You did really well. You just didn't quite make the cut. You needed to plant one more church in Riyadh. He says, depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. A worker of lawlessness is not someone who in some small way failed to keep the whole law all the time. A worker of lawlessness is someone who has actively worked against the law, who has run full speed in the other direction. Jesus isn't saying, sorry, you've got a record because you got caught for speeding. In Jesus' eyes, these folks launched an armed assault on City Hall. Workers of lawlessness are traitors and rebels. What is going on here? If we take these clues together, the before and the after, they point us toward poverty of spirit. They point us toward poverty of spirit. If you are poor in spirit, that means you know you lack something, that you have a poverty, and that only God can give you what you lack. You can't buy it, you can't earn it, you can't bargain for it, you can't manufacture it. You are totally dependent on God. You know that even if you are at the bottom of some mountain with God at the top, you have no hope of ever finding a path up the mountain. You need God to come down and rescue you. That's poverty of spirit. And the absence of that is what makes those folks in verses 22 and 23 workers of lawlessness. The problem is not their resume. The problem is that they come before Jesus and cite their resume. Instead of coming to him and saying, please, let us in. You have what we don't, and we need it. Would you give it to us, please? They come to him and say, look what I did to deserve it. I am rich in spirit. They cite Jesus their credentials. That's the opposite of poor in spirit. They lack any awareness of their lack. And so Jesus casts them out. So what you and I, what we all need first is to know how much we need. To begin to walk on the path of life, you have to see that on your own, you are dying. This means that the person who is confident they're all right because they're on their own path and no one has the right to judge them for that, and the person whose confidence is based on being here in church and giving money to missionaries and only using the officially approved Christian versions of swear words, we're all in the same amount of trouble. We are all equally poor before heaven. Listen, God gave you a lifetime. Just gave it to you at no cost to himself. So even if you were somehow to return it to him intact, to never mess it up in any way, and at the end of your life offer it back to him, you would just be square with the house. He still wouldn't owe you anything. Your account would read zero. And every time you do something wrong with the lifetime that God has so generously gave you, it's like you took Dad's car out for a spin and wrecked it. And every time you knowingly do something wrong, it's like you swiped Dad's credit card, got a fake ID, used it to run up a bar tab, and then drove his car intoxicated and wrapped it around a light pole. You're not paying off that debt. Don't stand before your heaven and argue that you have. Acknowledge that you are poor in spirit. We all need to cultivate this kind of poverty of spirit. We all need to meditate on the unbridgeable, enormous gulf that exists between us and God, us as God intended us to be and us as we are. Blaise Pascal was right when he said that there is a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of every person. We have no hope of filling such a void. But if we will acknowledge that, if we will admit that, then we can start to understand just how wonderful, just how undeserved it is that Jesus is even saying that there is a second option. That there's the possibility of a gate that leads to life, of a tree that bears fruit, of a house that lasts through the storm. Jesus doesn't owe us that. He doesn't need to give us a second option, but he does. We are desperately poor in spirit, and Jesus is here to say that God welcomes us back in anyway. Knowing that is the difference. Knowing that is the key to the second option, the option of life. But how does that key work? How does it really help? I mean, after all, verse 21 reads, "The one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven," not "the one who admits they cannot do the will of my Father who is in heaven." So how does poverty of spirit actually help? I mean, meditating on the gulf isn't going to erase it. How does this help us toward righteousness? The question takes us back to the context, to those three twos that Jesus gives us, gates and trees and houses, and that's where we're going to spend the rest of our time. But first, a note on the righteousness that we're pursuing. Righteousness is the same as doing the will of God, but it's not, don't imagine that it is following a list of rules. Righteousness, as Jesus describes it in the Sermon on the Mount, is not dotting your moral I's and crossing your ethical T's. Righteousness is entrance into the kind of life you were made for, into the kind of life that exists within God himself, a life of sacrificial, self-giving love. Poverty of spirit leads us toward that kind of life, not a clean rap sheet. Okay, so the different twos. The first one in verses 13 and 14. "Enter by the narrow gate. The gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. But the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few." We are continually faced with this choice between these two gates. On the one hand, we can build ourselves up. We can seal tight the airlock that protects us from the vacuum within us. We can seek to protect or improve our situation, our reputation, our resume. We can make life about us. This way is wide and easy because it is instinctive. It is our default mode. We all have this sort of automatic self-centeredness within us. You can take this road on cruise control and just let the days roll by like miles on the highway. If you are not thinking day in and day out about which path you're on, this is the path you're on. But on the other hand, we can face the fact that building ourselves up or protecting ourselves won't ultimately do us any good. That whether we succeed or fail, we will still be poor. We will still lack what we cannot gain. This way is narrow and hard because it cuts against our instincts. It takes poverty of spirit. It takes the settled certainty that you are not the hero of your own story. But it allows us to start giving ourselves away, to start moving out of the center, to start moving into life and righteousness. Take your career. You can take any career, doctor, professor, business owner, Costco cooler stocker, any career, and you can throw yourself into it for wide and easy reasons. You can work to amass a fortune, to amass a good reputation with colleagues or customers, a legacy of having done something worthwhile in the world, simply self-respect. And you might succeed or you might fail in your own eyes, but either way, the vacuum will still be there, all around you and within you. A career cannot make you righteous. On the other hand, you can pursue the same career for narrow and hard reasons, knowing full well that whether you achieve every single one of your stated goals or none of them, you will still be poor in spirit, but also knowing that God made you to work and inclined you towards certain kinds of work. If you accept that, you will never achieve the false and hollow sense of self-righteousness that we all waste so much energy pursuing, but you will learn to find joy in the work itself. Learn to feel a bit of God's pleasure at you, his creation, doing what he intended you to do. You won't make yourself rich in spirit, but you will slowly start to actually do righteousness. And look, I know many of you are pre or post or not, don't have a career, and that's fine, because what is true of a career is true of anything else. Family, politics, hospitality, volunteering, charity, study. You can pursue any of these things for wide and easy reasons, and no matter how good you get at it, you will still be hurtling through the void, waiting for the oxygen to run out. And you can pursue any of them in the hard, narrow way of spiritual poverty. And joy and righteousness in life will seep into your days and begin to fill the vacuum in your heart. There are two gates, and only two. Practice poverty of spirit. Take the narrow gate. After gates, in verses 15 to 20, Jesus turns to a discussion of trees and the fruit they bear. And this discussion applies to you on two levels. The first is that you are intended to be a tree that bears fruit, and then the second is that your teachers are also trees whose badness or goodness can be identified based on the fruit that they bear. So you are a tree. You are made to bear fruit, to bear righteousness, but like any tree, to do that you are totally dependent on outside sources. For any tree to bear fruit, it has to have sunlight and water and good soil and an array of other things that it cannot make itself and that it cannot go off in pursuit of. Right? Last spring, I planted 6 blueberry bushes in our front yard, and then in July, we went on vacation, and I set a hose timer to keep the bushes watered. But for some reason, one of 4 potential reasons, because I have 4 kids, the hose timer didn't work. And so the bushes endured 3 weeks of scorching July heat with no water. And when we came home, two of the bushes were all dead, three of the bushes were mostly dead, and one of them was thriving. The key is that the one that was thriving is the one planted closest to the city pipelines and was fed what it needed by slow leaks from the city water line and sewer line. Had nothing to do with the quality of the bushes. They are entirely dependent on where I put them and how I cared or didn't care for them. So you are a tree intended to bear fruit, but don't look inside of yourself for the resources to do so. Know that you are poor in spirit and look to Jesus, the good gardener, to put you where you need to be and give you what you need. And be patient with yourselves. Trees bear fruit slowly. It takes them years, and even the healthiest, most fruitful trees experience this thing called winter on a regular basis. The kingdom of heaven is not some mass production factory running three shifts where you have to crank out 80 units of righteousness a day if you want to keep your spot on the assembly line. The kingdom of heaven is an orchard where bruised reeds are not broken, where fragile saplings are tended and nurtured and grow in time. You are meant to bear fruit, but be patient with it. So that's the first application with the trees. And then the second one is more explicit in the text, and it's how to spot false teachers, which in a word is you'll know them by their fruit, which is not a word, that's a phrase. Jesus says, watch your teachers. Watch me. And watch for the kind of fruit Jesus is describing. You're not watching me for powerful, well-structured sermons or well-run meetings after church or for new building programs or young families joining the church. You're watching me for poverty of spirit, for a willingness to confess my own inadequacy, to say that the same vacuum that haunts you haunts me. And if God by grace doesn't speak life into my heart, I am a dead man walking. You're watching me to see if I am continually pointing you away from me and toward Jesus. That's the kind of fruit Jesus expects teachers to bear. And watch over time. Like I said, fruit grows slowly, so don't be fooled by first impressions, bad or good. Don't let up and stop watching because you figure I'm okay. And take the warning Jesus gives in verse 9 seriously, that a tree does not bear good fruit, needs to be cut down and cast into the fire. If you notice no fruit in me, it's time to cut me down. That doesn't mean you have to cast me out as a brother of Christ, but it does mean you have to fire me. Fruitless trees turn into workers of lawlessness. And they have no place tending King Jesus' orchard. Watch me to see if I am taking the narrow gate, because believe me, in ministry, the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction. And those who enter by it are many. So that's the trees. The third pair is in verses 24 to 27. Jesus ends his sermon with the story of two houses. I'm going to read it and listen here for what is the same between the houses, what is missing, and what is different. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rains fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat upon that house, but it did not fall because it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who builds their house on the sand. And the rains fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell. And great was the fall of it. What's the same? What's missing? What's different? What's the same is the storm. It's there in both cases. Suffering happens. If you're part of Calvin, I'm your pastor, and I pray for you. And I have to tell you, I don't bother praying for your life to be easy, for smooth sailing. That would be a waste of my breath. Suffering is a given. It is a constant. If it's not here in your life now, don't worry. It's coming. The storm is the same. The storm is the constant. But what's missing is any description at all of the houses. We have no idea if the two houses are the same or different, if they're big or small, if they were slapped together, or if they were built with loving, careful craftsmanship. Jesus doesn't bother describing the houses as one last reminder that your resume doesn't matter. It will not save you. What matters is the storm and the foundation. And the foundation is what's different. Build your life on Jesus. Build your life on the rock. And he promises to see you through every storm. But build your life on anything else. On personal integrity or family loyalty or self-actualization or professional accomplishment or community service. And the storms of suffering will sweep you away. Jesus is the rock. There is no other one. The options are him or your favorite kind of sand. The poverty in your spirit whispers the truth to you. Listen to it and build your life on Jesus. These aren't just words to Jesus. He practices this throughout his ministry. And so later in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus meets someone, one of these folks, with a killer resume. This guy is young, he's wealthy, he's well-respected. More than that, he's kept the law. This guy, he finished his PhD in engineering at 21, immediately got a great job. He would drive a Prius, except he doesn't even own a car. He rides his bike or takes the bus from home to work to the co-op to where he buys all his food. All his vacation time is spent using his expertise in impoverished areas to help them build lasting structures with the materials on hand. He is righteous in every way that we can observe. But he's still haunted by the vacuum, the God-shaped vacuum in his heart. And so he seeks Jesus out to ask, is there anything else? What am I missing? And at first, Jesus gives him the standard answer, do the will of my Father in heaven, keep the commandments. And this young guy, he gives the most honest response he can, which is, as far as I can tell, I have. I've done my best. And then Jesus gets intense and specific and personal and says, you're just missing one thing. Give away everything you have and follow me. The man can't do it. He turns down Jesus' offer and goes away. And saddened, Jesus tells his disciples, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter heaven. When Jesus says that, he's not just talking about bank accounts. He's talking about being rich in spirit. If you are under the impression that you in yourself have some of what you need and you can get the rest, Jesus is making you a bad offer. The price of giving up everything you have to get his righteousness is too high. And so you end up walking away from it. But if you are poor in spirit, if you have some sense of the shape and size of what's missing within you, and you know that Jesus and only Jesus has what you need, then you'll still recognize that the price of righteousness, of life, is too high for you to pay. But that will drive you to rejoice that Jesus already paid it for you and offers it to you freely. Jesus makes you an absolute offer. Jesus says to you, give me everything you have, and I'll give you everything you need. I will give you myself. That offer is the narrow gate that leads to life. That offer is the healthy tree that bears good fruit. That offer is the rock that will see you through every storm, is the God-shaped life that fills the vacuum in your weary soul. Take the offer. The Bible says humanity first came to life when God took the dust of the ground and breathed his Holy Spirit into it. And Jesus is saying to you that you can only find the life that he intends for you if you will admit that on your own, apart from his Spirit, you are but dust. The way to life runs through an eye of a needle. And if you would find your way through it, then you have to allow Jesus to reduce you to dust and lead you through and breathe his kind of life into you again. His kind of everlasting kingdom of heaven, righteous life.